Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul with us. And folks, we're currently going through the recommended amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And so we've covered quite a few of them, not all of them. And actually, I believe we covered, and I don't think we remember because it happened last week, right? Do you remember, right, Paul?
I don't remember.
Yeah, and see, that's what happens. But one of the things I do remember is what we didn't cover. And so we kind of covered this grant of temporary powers to regulate commerce. I believe we read through this, but I failed to place constitutional context to this. Now, remember that these were recommended amendments that were actually coming from the Continental Congress in seeking very specific capabilities to do their job. And so they keep going through, you know, that we have this responsibility, but we can't do this, or we're supposed to do this, but you're not responding, you know. So they wanted coercive powers. They wanted these things that would allow them to do their job, which makes sense, right? Now,
sure.
The reason we need to go through this, this is the grant of temporary power to regulate commerce. Now, if anybody wants to understand what the intent of regulating commerce, when we read the language in the U.S. Constitution, and let me do that real quick, because it is paramount that we place constitutional context to the clause actually in the Constitution, and it's right here, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. And among the several states, in other words, not within the states, among, to make sure that the states are behaving, you know, in accordance, you know, with, you know, goodwill and those types of things, not creating warfare. And they actually have some clarification to the Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 10, right?
Okay.
And so, and then they extend this. And with Indian tribes. So, in other words, they can regulate with foreign nations and with Indian tribes and among the several states, not within the states. Or actually, they don't have the ability to regulate interstate commerce, per se.
Not just intrastate, but interstate, between states.
That is correct. Only when there is an issue in the interstate shipment or the interstate commerce that creates a, like I said, an unfair advantage or a disability for other states and so forth, which is one of the reasons why they laid it clear here. So the reason that we're going to really focus on this is because there's this thing called the Department of Commerce. And as I was working this weekend in looking at the petitions, because, folks, we have a petition that calls out the calls for the dismantling of the Department of Commerce, calls for the dismantling of the Department of Interior, Department of Energy. And we're also working on an EPA, engineering, and a few other things. But that all being said, this particular request for an amendment really helps shine what they were seeking when it came to federal involvement in the regulation of commerce. And so the question I'm going to pose while you read, and folks, while you listen to Paul read, show me where the Continental Congress is looking to regulate states, you know, regulate commerce or interstate commerce. In other words, this concept of regulating among the states was literally to, because they were to be the traffic cop and to make sure that nobody was dominating, taking advantage, or anything like that. And I'll give you a case in point, because California was notorious for violating the Commerce Clause in the 1900s when it started regulating emissions, emission standards, and how you were going to produce products. I mean, they started implementing unconstitutional acts and laws in the state of California, and the federal government supported it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, oh, well, it's a noble thing, because the federal government actually started, and this is all in the Environmental Protection Agency petition, how the federal right. government started actually creating environmental policies in the early 1900s with parks and other things. And then later on, California started building on that, and the federal government just kind of loved that. They leached onto that and said, you know what? We're going to aggrandize that as well. We're going to make, you know, smog control. We're going to do these things as well.
Right.
Now, to be clear, a state does have the power to regulate itself regarding its air quality.
Okay.
If what?
No, go ahead. I'm listening.
No. I'm asking you, so they can do that if something is what? If it is enumerated in the state constitution.
Oh. Okay.
Okay, so I get it. You had no idea where I was going. So the point is, folks, that your state can do almost anything as long as it's enumerated in your state constitution. Because we're seeing this, you know, in the Iowa Constitution, where, you know, Iowa, South Dakota, these states are actually being wrangled into this unconstitutional webbing of the CO2 pipeline.
Right.
And this is all being stemming from all of these unconstitutional powers, the powers of the, you know, of over possessing land or regulating land or regulating commerce. The federal government doesn't have the ability to do that. Now, I'm going down a rat hole, but so forgive me. Mm-hmm. When you look at ethanol is clearly is something that can be done if a company, let's say Standard Oil, or let's say Shell, wants to, you know, implement an ethanol alternative to help, you know, stretch the use of gasoline or to reduce the consumption rate of gasoline. So they go down this path of doing that. You know, that company can do that, right?
Right. Correct.
As long as it's working within a very particular state where, you know, all of that stuff is kind of self-contained. In other words, let's say it's in a state where they're producing corn as well as where they're refining and mixing all of that type of stuff.
Okay.
Now, that means that Shell can start selling, and that, you know, they can do it at all their refineries, grow corn and all of that. But when they start creating when they start going into and buying corporate land, and taking agricultural land that is by the state, should be by the state's design, that land to be feeding people and or, you know, for the consumption for people, livestock, and so forth, because corn is one of those commodities, right? The corn, to be clear, how consumable is the corn for that they use for ethanol?
How consumable?
Yeah, I mean, who can eat it?
I don't know the science on that. I mean, I don't know that I can't, you know, throw it in a pot and eat it. I just don't know.
It's not designed for the consumption of people.
Okay.
And so you might be able to eat it, but its nutritional value just isn't there because it's engineered corn. This is modified engineered corn. This actually was the beginning of, you know, genetically modified corn or, you know, plants and so forth. That's what they started doing.
Right.
And so this opened up another rat hole, right? Of, you know, oh, now we want to start engineering all this food because they've been doing that as well. But anyway, going into this corn, so the state would then say, hey, hold on here. You know, Standard Oil, you're taking what we were planning on using as, you know, an agricultural product that goes into the, you know, the commodities base for the consumption by people and or livestock for feed. And you're now doing this so that it's not being sold per se, it's being brought straight in. In other words, how much money do they make from the production of that corn?
Okay.
So especially if they're growing it themselves, for themselves, right? So
right.
The bottom line is the state has a couple of issues here. They have an issue of whether they're making money, you know, and whether that money, if they are making money, then okay, is it the same? Does it have the same effect? But even more importantly, is the production of, you know, growing food for the consumption of cars versus people going to have an adverse effect on the, you know, the people of their state, whether, you know, because they may be growing in excess and they may have plenty, but that doesn't mean that across the United States and across the Union, it might actually create a shortage. Now, what happens when there's a shortage of corn, consumable corn? Well, the principles of supply and demand kick in. So what happens if the supply goes down?
Supply goes down, typically the price goes up.
Yeah, absolutely. The price will go up. And so this becomes a real benefit. And this is one of the things that, you know, states have to be very sensitive of, because, yeah, it may be benefiting one farmer over another farmer. And, you know, we don't want, I mean, I get the fact that you only want to grow as much food that's it's going to be consumed. But we
right.
all, but I think the states have a responsibility of having a supply, a food supply for their people. It's not a federal, the federal government does not have the power or responsibility of having the food reserves. And as a matter of fact, they've proven that they've used the food reserves to manipulate global markets. And
sure.
that's what happened for the Arab Spring. But nevertheless, the whole point I'm trying to get into is that the federal government should not at all be involved in regulating these types of things, because look at what's happening. If we mm-hmm. really start peeling this apart and we look at how they've aggrandized this concept of regulating everything related to commerce,
right,
then it flies in the face of really what they were seeking to do and what they enumerated in the Constitution. So that's why I'm asking you to be a little more, you know, attentive to this in this very particular way, as well as the people.
Okay. So what's happened over the years is the Commerce Clause has been really abused by the federal government. And what you're saying is this document, grant of temporary power to regulate commerce, gives us context for what should really be happening. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, correct, because the whole point of regulating commerce had everything to do with foreign. The fact that they injected regulating commerce among the states was basically that they would have jurisdiction between commerce conflicts between the states.
Otherwise, the states should be easily able to freely trade with one another.
Correct. They have full autonomy from the federal government. Autonomy. Only when there becomes disputes between states does the federal government, can they get involved. And to be clear, just because there's a dispute does not open the door for the federal government to aggrandize themselves and compromise the sovereignty of the states. The whole point of being the traffic cop is to protect the sovereignty of the state. So when we have a group of states that is actually, you know, threatening the sovereignty and having an adverse effect on another state, then their job is to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Right. You know, that's not their mindset right now. I think there would have to be a wholesale change in Congress. But before, I want to hit something
sure.
that we discussed in a previous, you brought it up just a little bit ago about California. And I think in a previous broadcast, we talked about California's regulation on cars. And what it meant is that Detroit, or whoever else is making cars, had to make cars for California and cars for the rest of the country. And right. what you pointed out was, if California wanted cars a certain way, then why don't they build them themselves?
Right.
Right? Instead right. of, in other words, they can't tell the other states what to build. All right?
Right.
But they can invite, say, hey, GM, Ford, or Chrysler, why don't you come to California and build it our way? But, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. And so that's, wanted to do that for clarity. I remember that. So I'm ready to read whenever you are.
Right. Okay. Okay. And so to be clear, it's let me dive into that a little bit more.
Okay.
So let's say you as a state pay and you get the car manufacturers to integrate what you want, mm-hmm. what you want for that company to sell.
Okay.
That when they bring it into your state, it meets your standards. Where the federal government isn't being the strong arm for the state of California and saying, you got to do this because we now set these federal standards. Mm-hmm. So the California has to basically convince them and convince their people that buying these things that they're shipping into their state is, great. I mean, this is the best thing for all of us. That still does not take away. Bless you.
Sorry, GR.
That's okay. So the fact that the state of California got all of the automobile manufacturers to meet their emission standards does not give the state of California the control over their citizens, unless it's in their constitution, to say, we will regulate what you buy in this state and even when you leave this state.
Ooh.
In other words, that doesn't mean that a person living in the state of California could not go to Arizona, Nevada, or any state of their choice, buy that car, and bring it back to license it. And California is violating their own citizens' rights. Because they do not have this enumerated in their constitution that they can control what their citizens buy and own.
Wow. I had not thought of that. You're right.
Right, because the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States are to be protected and cannot be abridged by a state making or enforcing a law that abridges those privileges or immunities. So right. the freedom to actually travel, purchase things, and bring them back is a privilege and immunity that, and as a matter of fact, even if California made this a constitutional amendment, there's still the privilege and immunity of the Ninth Amendment.
Okay.
Which means, and when I read the Ninth Amendment, because let me pull it over here, and I'm going to read the Ninth Amendment because it's one of those catch-all amendments. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, if the state of California has an enumerated power that can actually deny and or disparage the rights of people to be able to do something, then that part of that Constitution is unconstitutional.
Okay.
So my point is that, we live in a land that is so, I'll just say, where liberty is so well guarded and protected that it's almost impossible for a state to be tyrannical. And yet every government in the United States today is a velvet glove or an iron fist cladded with a velvet glove.
Right. Yeah.
And so anyway. All right. Okay. So let's go ahead now with context to this regulating, because we just kind of were breezing through and reading these things. And I go, you know what? We did not really focus on this particular amendment and we just read it. So go ahead.
Here we go.
All right.
Grant of temporary power to regulate commerce, 30 April 1784. The trust reposed in Congress renders it their duty to be attentive to the conduct of foreign nations and to prevent or restrain, as far may be, all such proceedings as might prove injurious to the United States. The situation of commerce at this time claims the attention of the several states, and few objects of greater importance can present themselves to their notice. The fortune of every citizen is interested in the success thereof, for it is the constant source of wealth and incentive to industry, and the value of our produce and our land must ever rise or fall in proportion to the prosperous or adverse state of trade. Already has Great Britain adopted regulations destructive of our commerce with her West India Islands. There was reason to expect that measures so unequal and so little calculated to promote mercantile intercourse would not be preserved in by an enlightened nation. But these measures are growing into system. It would be the duty of Congress, as it is their wish, to meet the attempts of Great Britain with similar restrictions on her commerce. But their powers on this head are not explicit, and the propositions made by the legislatures of the several states render it necessary to take the general sense of the Union on this subject. Unless the United States and Congress assembled shall be vested with powers competent to the protection of commerce, they can never command reciprocal advantages in trade, and without these, our foreign commerce must decline and eventually be annihilated. Hence, it is necessary that the states should be explicit and fix on some effectual mode by which foreign commerce, not founded on principles of equality, may be restrained. That the United States may be enabled to secure such terms, they have resolved. That it be, and it hereby is recommended to the legislatures of the several states, to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years with power to prohibit any goods, wares, or merchandise from being imported into or exported from any of the states in vessels belonging to or navigated by the subjects of any power with whom these states shall not have formed treaties of commerce. Resolved that it may be, that it be and hereby is recommended to the legislatures of the several states to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years with the power of prohibiting the subjects of any foreign state, kingdom, or empire, unless authorized by treaty, from importing into the United States any goods, wares, or merchandise which are not the produce or manufacture of the dominions of the sovereign whose subjects they are, provided that to all acts of the United States and Congress assembled in pursuance of the above powers, the assent of 9 states shall be necessary.
Right. And so when we read this, that last line was, you know, kind of like what sent us down a specific trail of this assent of 9 states.
Right.
And we missed completely the fact that they were clearly in this amendment seeking only to regulate foreign commerce. There's nowhere in here where they even touch the commerce within states or even among the states. Am I true? Or did you read anything that felt like it was really pointing to their desire to regulate the commerce within the states and the interstate commerce?
It was specifically foreign commerce.
That's right. So when a couple of years later, the men that were involved in this particular amendment in that constitutional convention, and knowing that this was something that they needed to do, they added to the Constitution this short little clause giving the Congress the power to regulate foreign commerce and among the states, right? And commerce among the states and with Indian tribes. That's it. So
right,
where do we presume that the federal government can now come in? And we're going to be running out of time in just a second. Can come in and actually tell light bulb manufacturers that they have to manufacture light bulbs that generate a certain amount of energy, or, you know, that they can't contain these types of metals, or anything regarding the manufacturing of a light bulb, toilet, or any product that you choose. In other words, today, well, let's talk about economic systems. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we kind of laid out this concept of regulating commerce that they were seeking, and then when we look at regulating commerce altogether, that really speaks to an economic system, does it not?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so what is, constitutionally, what is our economic system supposed to be?
The first thing that comes to mind is free market.
There you go. Okay. So what would constitute a free market? Well, technically, and let me just expound on this, what and how would you define a black market?
A black market?
A black market.
It's kind of an underground market, you know, where people are buying goods and services that are under the radar.
Yeah, so actually, let me give you a really good definition of a black market. A black market has zero regulations or zero effects of government. In other words, it is minus government regulation.
Okay.
In other words, a black market is actually what we call a black market. Today is what we used to have that we called a free market.
Okay.
Right? Because a free market means that it is not regulated by government. Now, our states have implemented sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they basically have created, the states have created a mechanism, almost all states. Now, there are some states that have no sales tax.
Right.
Oregon is one of them. And so any transaction that happens between one person and another person, there, you know, you do not have to report that transaction.
Right.
Now, in most states, those transactions are regarded as a transaction with a place of business and a consumer.
Right.
In other words, the place of business has to report, but an individual person can barter and or trade and have a transaction with another private party, another individual, without having to report that sales tax.
Right.
Now, states are becoming more and more draconian and saying, you know what, we're not getting enough of your money. So, folks, just remember this one statement. We don't have a tax problem. We have a spending problem, which drives government that wants to tax you more.
Right.
When government does more and more, they need more and more of your money. So when they say, oh, well, we've got, you know, we all have a tax problem because they're just taking no, they're taking more of your money because they're doing more that they probably don't have the authority to do.
Right.
So before you even consider, you know, undoing taxes or anything else, you have to basically get your arms around what is government spending their money on that they should not be spending a penny on. And if, you know, if they need that, if they need to spend money on it and it's not within the Constitution, I'll give you a good case in point. Let's say the Constitution, right? Let's say that, or not the Constitution, transportation. Let's say your state does not have anything in it because it's been relying upon this federal usurpation of the Department of Transportation that, you know, that's how they do all of their roads, highways, and so forth. And they've created these regulations driven by all of those standards coming from the federal government. And there's no mention of a highway, waterway, or any forms of transportation in your state constitution. Then that means, because do you really want to not have the ability to travel with, you know, government assistance? I think that we need state assistance in creating roads. I don't want to pay for a road to go to everywhere I want to go.
Right.
Now, we can go down that path, but I tell you what, it's a very insidious path. When you go down the path of saying, well, I kind of want, because what that means, folks, is that you have to pay for your driveway and that little private road, and everybody on that has to pay for the creation and the maintenance of that. And that gets really, really expensive. Why? Because you have to pay the full cost, you know, 5, 10, 15 years or whatever it takes when all of a sudden you have a bunch of potholes on your street and you say, well, we need to get this fixed.
And you got to pay it, right?
Right. And the private company that's going to come in is going to be a lot more expensive than having your state and your local government actually doing all of it because it's called the economy of scale. You pay for it, you'll pay a lot more money because if they manage our highways, it becomes a lot cheaper, our roadways and our road systems. And so I know there's people that argue this all the time, and they keep on missing this whole point that if you have to pay, that means that you're not only paying for the access to your driveway, you're going to pay for every road you access, your neighbor's, you know, community road, you know, all the roads you take that get through your community out to the main road, and you're going to pay for that main road. And then you're going to pay for every road you get on. In other words, every day you pay a toll.
Every mile of every road you use.
And not only that, you're going to be paying the bureaucracy of managing the toll system. Now, is it not cheaper just to let government have that responsibility?
There's an infrastructure there that government has kind of always done, okay?
Right.
In our lifetimes, you know, in, you know, I was watching a video of, you know, civilization in the ancient Middle East, and, you know, there were roads. These are paths marked by people walking on them. And so they probably didn't pay for those. They just walked on them. But we don't walk in our modern society. The roads have to be built, and they have to be paid for. And
So as we started developing this country, the first thing that they had long before we even had a federal government and a constitution, they had wagons. And you just can't take it, folks, I'd love to see anybody just grab a wagon, put it in the middle of the wilderness, and say, okay, take that wagon wherever you want to go.
It's not going to happen.
It won't happen. It won't. As a matter of fact, that wagon would be busted up because, you know, it's not designed to take those rigors. I mean, when we look at the cars and the technology and the way we've developed all of this, it's just amazing that we pay what we do for those cars. And the reason we pay what we do for cars is really because of this thing called the economy of scale.
Right.
I look, because in systems engineering, we had to buy these things called tape drive robots. And, it's a chassis that would hold all your backup tapes and some tape drives and some robotic, you know, arms with very little technology in comparison to your car today. No safety features, anything else. Basically, basic mapping of a robotic arm to go and grab something and put it into a drive and keeping track of all of that little stuff, you know, for the computer. Right. I mean, it's not that complicated. And you pay for this small 100 tape drive from ADIC back in 2015, 2014. That 100 tape drive, I mean, we're talking about something less than 3 feet by 2 feet by, you know, 2.5 feet. I mean, something small, smaller than the car. You could not get into this thing. And it would cost over $50,000.
Wow.
$50,000. Why? Because supply and demand. You know, you got to have it. You got to do your backups. Your data is precious. You got to back that stuff up. Mm-hmm. And so to have that stuff onto tape, because tape, especially if you've got lots of data and you're making lots of changes and you want to do these things all the time, you know, it's cheaper to do it to tape. So your cost of moving all of your backups to tape, you know, is a lot cheaper than doing online backups. You know, where you're moving your data from one drive to another. And I don't mean to get into the engineering. I'm just trying to help emphasize that.
I've been there, GR. I have used tape drives. I have supported them. I have, you know, so I know what you mean. Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So So my point is, folks, that when we look at certain things, because, you know, it's the free market is designed to capitalize on your ability to use or buy, you know, from a multitude of suppliers. When it comes to roads, when it comes to infrastructure, our telephone lines, our power lines, our water lines, you've heard me say this before. You do not have competition. So therefore, we do want our state, and if our state, this is why I advocate that your state actually has in its constitution the power to basically provide to the counties the system and the funding for, you know, these interconnections of the network, interconnections of phone systems, interconnections of waterways or what have you, if it is suitable. In other words, there are mechanisms and ways that, I mean, I live in an area, and you probably may have lived in areas like that, where you can't, it's not economically feasible to come up with a landline, or I should say a physical line for your network, for your, you know, cable, TV, that type of stuff. Now, interestingly enough, you know, the cable companies have seemed to do a really good job in dragging cable out to every house. But in your real rural America, the cost of dragging that cable out to that home, it's just not there.
Right.
Either you do it yourself, as you pipe in everything else, your electrical and all of that. And here's the thing. When you pipe in your electrical, because your cable, your infrastructure, I should say, your internet and cable is not provided by the state, it's not included in that line.
Right.
I know lots of rural areas that actually do have, you know, water lines where you don't have to have a well, you don't have to have a septic system, you don't, you know, you at least have electrical.
Right.
I mean, I don't know of any place that doesn't have electricity. Why is it that they have electricity, but they don't have cable? Because we have allowed cable to be a private market. And folks, when you look at how much money you pay for these corporate fat cats, I believe that we the people, could administer our infrastructure at more efficient and probably much better minded strategically. I mean, when we look at our electric grid, and our electric grid was managed by government, we didn't think about strategies and so forth. But today, it is all public utilities that are private organizations, right?
Sure.
And so how is our grid today as far as resilience? In other words, these people are pocketing millions of dollars every year with their bonuses and everything else, all of these different CEOs and so forth. They're walking away, and it's disgusting that we have a grid and a system that, you know, is inept and inadequate for the potential threats that we're dealing with, and vulnerable as much as it is.
Oh, yeah. It's. I was just watching a couple things last week of how vulnerable our grid is. Yeah, strikes in just a few places could take down the entire grid. And what they say is, you know, this is really easy to fix.
Yes.
It's not that hard to fix, I think. And so here's the question I want to ask, okay? Because I can hear people crying, uh-oh, it sounds like they're saying, you want to nationalize the utilities. And the next thing they're going to say is, that's communism, right?
Well, so no, not really, because if it can't be an open and free market, then how is it a free market system? In other words, you know, it has to be either a mercantile system or a government utility.
See, what has happened is it has evolved to the point where it's required now to it's literally required to do commerce. There's some commerce I can't do unless I do it online, right?
Right.
And because of that, because it's required, everyone needs it. And I remember when it wasn't, but it was a short span, and it happened quickly. And so we're now in a position, like you say, we've got competing cable companies for what? Content? The only reason they're competing is because of content. The wire is pretty much the same.
And, you know, here's the thing. They've paid for that wire. As a matter of fact, as they laid out fiber, mm-hmm. you know, the fiber is more than competent or capable of growing the data and everything else. The only reason why you're paying for the little data that you're getting through that fiber is mm-hmm. only due to the fact that they haven't upgraded, and they want to make sure that they still make their profits so that they can slowly upgrade the system to keep, as long as, you know, they're able to keep up demand. And actually, you know, they make ways of charging you more money.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, you know, if we had an internet system that was honest, mm-hmm. and it was a utility, we wouldn't be paying but for how much data we consumed.
Right.
You'd just be paying for the subscription.
Sure.
That's it. And it's the same thing with electricity. Why is it that we're not just paying for a subscription of electricity instead of, well, because people are relating to the fuel and so forth. But, you know, anyway, that's a whole other topic and another problem that we can solve, but it's not for us at this point. We're trying to focus on all these amendments. So the next amendment is
amendment to grant commercial powers to Congress.
There you go.
28 March 1785.
Right.
I think we can get this in 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's less than a page. It's about a half a page.
Okay. So here we go. That the first paragraph of the ninth of the Articles of Confederation be altered so as to read thus, viz. Quote, the United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the sixth article of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, of regulating the trade of the states as well with foreign nations as with each other, and of laying such duties and imposts upon imports and exports as may be necessary for the purpose, provided that the citizens of the states shall in no instance be subjected to pay higher imposts and duties than those imposed on the subjects of foreign powers.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, because we're going to take a quick pause on this.
Okay.
When we look at these treaties, what are these treaties to regard?
Well, trade.
So they actually mention two things here, war and trade.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay.
In other words, peace accords mm-hmm. and trade. But there's no treaty ever or the concept of subjugating our government to another government or to a foreign pool of government like the UN it's not even fathomable. These men would never have thought about surrendering our sovereignty to another governing agency or entity at all.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So I think I left off, shall in no instance be subjected to pay higher imposts and duties than those imposed on the subject of foreign powers, provided also that the legislative power of the several states shall not be restrained from prohibiting the importation or exportation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, provided also that all such duties as may be imposed shall be collected under the authority and accrue to the use of the state in which the same shall be payable. And provided, lastly, that every act of Congress for the above purpose shall have the assent of 9 states in Congress assembled, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land or water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided or appropriated by granting letters of marque and reprisal in time of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed judge of any of the said courts.
Okay, so you know I'm going to go back to that one line that was next that you covered, but I wanted you to finish reading, because the one that really stands out, provided also that the legislative power of the several states shall not be restrained from prohibiting the importation or exportation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
They were spelling it out, folks. They're not looking to regulate what you bring in and what you're exporting.
Right.
They never had the intent to regulate to that degree. That was not the point of regulating commerce among the states, because it's clear right there, because within the state means importation and or exportation.
And this carried over into the Constitution. In other words, this was their mindset.
Yes, absolutely. These were the same men, practically the same men that had been involved in all of this and involved in the other conventions. They're looking at these amendments and going, okay, well, these failed. Now what are we going to do? Now they finally had – now this is in what year? 85?
1785,
so the March of 85. So a little over a year later, this is when they had the Annapolis Convention in September, I believe, September 86. And then they later on produced, which actually I believe Continental Congress produced the response in January of 87 to call for the convention. Mm-hmm. And folks, you know, it's not like a whole bunch of people died because of generational time had passed, you know, and then they created the Constitution with this new age thought.
Mm-hmm.
They went in, and we're going to cover this to ad nauseum, because that's what yours truly does. I want to make sure that there is zero doubt when it comes down to anybody making the assertion that that constitutional convention was a runaway convention.
Mm-hmm.
So we're painfully going through this. It's actually taken me 1 month to lay this out.
Okay.
And so this is very, very clear, because we're not only defining, you know, this constitutional process, but we're helping define the Constitution in many of these amendments,
mm-hmm.
which means it really explains why these lines were written the way they were. As a matter of fact, the Convention of State folks are out there saying, oh, well, they didn't really define the Commerce Clause that well. What do you mean? Regulate commerce among the states. That's as fine as they needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
That because it did not grant them the power to regulate commerce within the states or between the states, only among the states. And we'll get into this even more, because interstate, every state had the right to actually export. It was only when you had states that were either taking advantage or playing games like California and not allowing you to put that stuff in. I'll give you a current case of commerce, the Commerce Clause being violated. The state of Wyoming has been trying to ship coal out mm-hmm. of Wyoming, out of a Pacific port. And there's not one Pacific port along the West Coast willing to allow the exportation of coal because it's an evil substance. And so they create these environmental, in other words, they created rules that deny the state the ability to use those states to export through them to an, and they can't do that. That violates the Commerce Clause. When state of Washington, and the state of Washington was first, and then, because why? It was the most direct line through the rail line from Wyoming to, out to the port of Seattle. Boom, it would have been done. So anyway, this kind of closes out this particular one. Now we have 3 minutes to review, and let me see, what is the next one? The next one is the last one, and the Articles of Confederation proposed by a committee of Congress, and this is a lot of articles in it. And so
what's the title of it?
Okay, I'm sorry. Amendments to the Articles of Confederation proposed by a committee of Congress, and this is 7 August 1786. And so this precedes that convention in Annapolis. And by the way, if I remember correctly, only a few states showed up.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
A few states showed up to this or the convention in Annapolis?
To the convention in Annapolis. In other words, they sought this particular amendment, and it went out in August, and so they formed this convention in September and said, hey, you know, we need to do something. And that's when it finally came out from Congress that following January, like we just said, that we need to have a convention for, you know, fixing the union and fixing this constitution. Because remember, the Articles of Confederation, they referred to as their constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And they just renamed it as a constitution for the United States. And that's a capital U, folks.
Right.
The first time United States was used by the framers was in the Declaration of Independence, where the U was little U. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they were sovereign and independent states, and the Articles of Association had not truly created a government. It only created a union. In other words, they were little U, not big U. When they actually formed a central and generalized government, because this was just basically a co-op. The Continental Congress at that time was a co-op. They had no governing powers. And so they had to go out and declare independence. And then after they declared independence and was ratified, the following year was the creation of the Articles of Confederation. So they finally formed a government. It's really important, folks, that we realize that the Declaration of Independence did not government create.
Right.
In other words, we had to create a government in response to that declaration if we were going to have, you know, I'll just say, you know, this union or this unified concept of, you know, these independent states being united. And so that's why it was a little U with the declaration and then big U, because they were united into a union under these things. So with that, folks, we will be back tomorrow. We'll go through this next amendment, and then probably we will dive into the analysis of what they did and how it ended up, you know, creating the Constitution and how it's perceived today, and these misconceptions like the runaway convention and so forth. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution?
To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.